Okay, I'm just gonna like soak it in for a minute because I'm a little nervous. My name is Kalei and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is March 23rd, 2004. Okay, so it's been several years since I've spoken in front of a big, large group like this. And I have to remember that you guys are my friends and it's a loving place. So to start off, I'll start off with my background. I was born and raised in California, Central California, Hayward. And my mom, single parent. I get comfortable here because I'm here for an hour. So, 45 minutes, okay, perfect. So growing up, I wouldn't say I necessarily had a normal childhood, but you know, I didn't come from an abusive home. My mom is not an alcoholic, nor is my dad. But at the age of 5, they split up, they divorced, and so now I was on my own with my mom and my brother, and we pretty much roamed California. So it was kind of a running joke that my mom was a gypsy, and I went to a lot of different schools. Not a lot of stability. Her father is an alcoholic, so if that tells you anything right there. But growing up, you know, I Catholic school from kindergarten all the way through high school. Went to Mission College Preparatory School. I had, you know, the image of this perfect kid who got good grades, who did good, and overall, I was a pretty good kid, I think. My brother, now he was the fuck up, but he, yeah. So growing up, you know, I didn't have a lot of dysfunction, so to speak, but in a sense, there was always something that was missing in my life, and so. At about, let's see, 17, I'll start off with my first drink. And I wasn't one of those people that had a drink when I was 10. I didn't sneak any drinks. But at 17, I had gone to a party, like a normal, typical teenager probably does, behind their parents' back. And I lived in a predominantly Hispanic area. My mom is Puerto Rican Spanish, and my dad is very white. And so, went to this party, and I had this sort of image to uphold. I was this badass. I was this person who didn't take any crap. You know, I held up that image really well. And I remember they had, it was like a box of Old English. And I had never drank before, ever. And so I took one of the 40s, and I proceeded to twist off the cap. And I remember thinking, oh, it smells horrible. But I thought, I'm just gonna go with it. You know, I've got this image I've gotta up, you know, kind of upkeep here. And I remember to this day, I remember taking it and putting it to my lips and smelling it. And I thought, huh, that smells okay. And I remember taking that gulp. And now I didn't just drink like a little sip. I remember putting my head back. And I remember I pretty much drank the entire 40 in one head nod back. And it was easy. And I remember after I was done, about 7 people looked at me and they had this like they couldn't believe that I had just done that. To me, that was normal. I mean, that it felt fine. I felt good. And that at that point, I had arrived, because that's suddenly that feeling of irritable and discontent, everything, you know, not fitting in, having to pretend to be somebody that I wasn't. I remember strutting through that party, and I was really, really good looking, and I was really smart, and I was really popular, and that night then proceeded to another oldie. And so by the time I had gotten home, like I always hear a lot of stories when people say, oh, I had gone home, you know, I drank all this and then I puked and I felt horrible. I didn't puke at all. Matter of fact, I didn't even have a headache. I woke up the next day and I felt fantastic. And I thought, well, this is perfect. This is the drink for me. Definitely. Oldie. That's where my life had come. So my story, it's interesting because at 17, 18, I graduated high school. I begged my mother to put me in public school for the last year. So she did. So I went from Catholic school to public school, and I got pregnant, like the good Catholic girl that I was. And now I was pregnant, and I had finished high school, and I had this baby now I was gonna try to take care of, and I was gonna try to go to college at the same time, and I had all these plans and these ideas. But drinking was still very much there. I found at that point any room to drink, whether sneaking it, whether it was finishing up the booze that was left at parties, family parties, and still kept up this facade that I was this perfect schoolgirl, and my mom was definitely fooled for a really long time. At about 20 or so, 21, I'm now able to get into bars. And I wasn't one of those people that got a fake ID or nothing. I did everything by the book, didn't break any rules. And at that point, my drinking career pretty much had accelerated. Now I was definitely trying to manage being a full-time mom and drinking now. And this was definitely getting in the way of my drinking career for sure. There was a lot of, leaving Michaela with the neighbor, leaving Michaela with the family member. Anytime I could get away from her, I did. And I loved my daughter with all my heart, but I'll tell you right now, that drink was pretty, pretty important to me. Drugs do play a story in my life, although I didn't even touch drugs until I was about 22. So drinking, for me, when they say, how do you know you're an alcoholic? Well, drinking for me, alcohol was always very important to me from that time that I took that first drink to that time. It was consistent. And although my years of drinking, if you really think about it, wasn't that long from the time that I got sober at 30 years old. But I'll tell you right now, I did a lot of damage from 17 to 30. So much damage that... it took even many years after getting into recovery to really correct a lot of the stuff that I had done. I always had this job. I had a home. My story isn't one of those stories where I wasn't arrested. I didn't get a DUI. I didn't have my kids taken away from me. I didn't sleep in a car. I have never gone hungry. But I'll tell you that emptiness and that despair that I felt when I didn't have the drink existed all the time. And I don't know if that stems back from my childhood. I don't know. I mean, in recovery, we do a lot of inside work, and we have to in order for me to stay sober. I have to look at not why I was drinking, not the drink, but why I was drinking. What had happened in my life that I felt this way. With my parents divorcing when I was 5, that was pretty major. I did have something traumatic happen to me at 5 that did involve sexual abuse. And I say that because that is my story. And I won't go into detail about that, but I think it's important to mention it because it's who I am today. I had a lot of family, I had a lot of support, I had a lot of love. None of that was lacking in my life, but I'll tell you what was lacking was that security of knowing that I had this feeling of never being accepted, of always wanting more. The loneliness always existed. So at about 22, 23, I decide it's a great idea to sleep with my boss. Perfect. So he was like 10 years older. He had a lot of money. Yeah, I mean, it made sense to me, total sense. And so I did, and we then have a daughter together. So now I have two kids. Michaela is my oldest, and Mackenzie is my youngest daughter. And I really tried hard to fit into that mold of that suburban wife, so to speak. We had, you know, we lived in Lake Forest Park. We had the nice house. We had the boat. We had all these things. We had a bank account. We had all the stuff that you would think would make me happy. And he was a normie. Bless his heart, he was a normie, and he drank wine. And I had never tasted wine before, ever. And I thought, wow, this is something new. And I remember taking that first sip, just like that old E, and I thought, well, I definitely graduated here, because I went from old E, and now I'm drinking the best wine from Trader Joe's. I was like, I've definitely arrived now. And in my story, you know, I think about it, I have arrived several times in my drinking career. I didn't have just one moment where I arrived. I arrived many times, and I thought, this is it, you know? I mean, I've got this life now. Everybody would really want this life that I had. But again, there is that I lived a double life. That's the only way that I can explain. I was driving here and I was thinking to myself how to explain it, but it was like a coin, the two different sides. So one side I showed to the family was the working woman, the wife, the mother, the person who went to PTA meetings, who went to soccer. And then there was that other person who really liked to party. Really liked to party. And I liked to have a good time. I was not a rager. I was a life of the party, so I thought. And I wasn't a blackout drinker. I definitely had it down to science. 2 to 3 glasses of wine a night, perfect. It just was that perfect ease. Anything a little bit more than that, I was pissing in the kitchen sink. That was definitely not where I needed to be. So I had sort of a science, you know, about it. And I thought, and I definitely couldn't do drugs and drink, because it was really like, I would definitely lose control at that point. But it got to a point where I was telling so many lies. I would come home after partying, and he would be home with the kids, and I would then pretend like I was sleeping, and I had been up all night partying. And I did that for quite a long time, that whole story of literally, like, I mean, when I think about how I lived, it's pretty crazy. And that went on for a couple more years, to about 26 or so, he decided that I had a problem. I had drained the bank accounts. I had, cheated on him more than I could probably count on my hands. I was not, and none of that had really come out, because remember, I kept that real, that other side of me, no one really knew. My family didn't know. My mom is a doctor. My aunt is a psychiatrist. You know, I came from this educated family of women who was very self-sufficient, and I could not let them know that I was spiraling out of control. So I spent a lot of my time and energy pretending. It's the only way I can say it, pretending to be somebody, pretending not to be somebody, pretending that I had it all together. Until finally, he knew that there was something going wrong, because every time he would bring the bottle of wine home and we were supposed to have it for dinner, by the time dinner came, the bottle would be gone. I would then say to him, oh, well, didn't you know we drank that last night? He's like, no, Kalei, we didn't drink. We just got this. We just got this today. And he then brought it to my family's attention, and they decided they were going to do an intervention on me. That didn't go over very well. I told them all where they could take it, and stormed out of the intervention and told them all that they were crazy and that I didn't have a problem. You know, I had this job. I was an operations manager for Virginia Mason Hospital in Seattle. I I had a good job. Don't you know who I am? You know, and again, still trying to maintain that control. And for me, that control was really important to me, to always keep that. So when the time came when, you know, let's go back for a minute. When I was a teenager, and even before I had that drink, you know, I surrounded myself with people that were not genuine. My oldest daughter's father is a very well-known gang member in California. I was involved with a lot of criminal activity before I even knew that it was really criminal activity. I really just went along for the ride. When I did my inventory in recovery and I went back in time and I, you know, because it was almost like, although I didn't black out, I sure as heck fogged out everything that I did not want to remember. Oh, I threw a girl over the pier and I didn't know if she knew how to swim. Oh, did I really do that? Are you sure that was me? Or, you know, oh, I helped you rob Circle K. Like, I, you know, there are certain things in my story where I really blocked out. I did not want to believe that I was that person that would do that. Because, you know, I had this sort of back and forth thing where, you know, I don't have split personality. But you know, anybody who were to meet me back then would probably say, you know, there's something mentally wrong with you because, you know, you've got this stuff going on and then now, you know, and now you're pretending like you're this housewife. So I did that for a long time. And so by the time I was about 26 or so, my mom said to me, you know, Clay, if you're not an alcoholic, quit for 30 days, just 30 days. And I looked at her and I said, what, really, come on, 30 days, it's no big deal. I went home and I got a calendar out. The calendar, because, you know, back then, we didn't have I didn't use my phone for the calendar. I had it, like, you know, in front of me. And I remember counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And literally, and I'm going, by the time I hit 12, I was like, holy shit, that's a lot of days. I don't know if I can do this. And that was a moment where I would say that epiphany where God, I think, talked to me. And I thought, maybe I do have a problem. That moment of like where I put my head down and I knew that something wasn't right. But again, wasn't going to let anybody know that. Wasn't time yet. And no problem. I got this. I can quit for 30 days. Not a problem. So for me, I mean, when I got into the program, so by the time I was 30, I got sober. And my mom's friend took me to a woman's meeting over in Linwood on the other side of the water. And it was a meeting full of women, and let's just say I didn't have a lot of female friends, so, you know, and I thought, oh my God, she's taking me to an all-women's meeting, great. They're all going to be crying, sure enough, they were crying, and it was just a hot mess in there, and I thought, this is what my life has become, this is it, right? And I remember looking at the door like, where is the exit doors, you know, how can I get out of here quickly? But somewhere in the meeting, and it was an hour meeting, and about 30 minutes into the meeting, I felt this, like, my heart just sort of tighten. And I felt, and I don't even remember what stories I heard, but all I remember feeling was that feeling where I could identify. I could identify with what these women were talking about in there. And I was scared to death. I didn't know at that point what the hell I was going to do, you know. Did I need treatment? Did I need, you know, I remember thinking of this in my mind while I was in the meeting. And by the end of the meeting, here I am crying with all the women in the meeting. And I'm like, fuck, this is great. You know, this is perfect. So, and at that point, that was the first day that I was sober. And, So yeah, so my drinking career, if you really think about it, like, I mean, I could go on and on about my drunken logs, you know, and I spent a lot of time, you know, drinking, but really what I identified in the Big Book was there's a story in the back in the personal stories where they talk, and it's a woman who is by herself and she's got the curtains closed and she's drinking by herself. And I really related to that because that was me. I didn't need a party. I didn't need to go to a party. Although I like to go to parties, I didn't need it. I drank by myself and I used drugs by myself, period. And I thought for a long time that I was okay because my kids were in bed, my rent was paid, I had a job to go to. You know, what was the big deal? I had it all covered. And I really thought at that point, you know, that it was normal for me to drink a bottle of wine a night and to have a little bit of cocaine, because what was the problem with that, right? And doing laundry, you know, while I had the fire going and I, you know, listening to Pink Floyd in the background. I mean, that was like, this is perfect. Like, this is the life. Yeah, this is right where I need to be. I was by myself. You know, the husband left at that point, you know, and I really thought that that was okay. I really, really thought that was okay. I didn't realize that it was not okay until I started coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I realized, holy shit, I'm really sick. You know, and what I put my kids through, you know, my oldest daughter, who is 22 now, she decided at 10 years old to go live with my mom. She said, you know what, I can't do this anymore, Mom. And I remember thinking, oh, okay, so she just wants a little bit of a variety, a change. I didn't really put two and two together. My youngest daughter decided that she was going to live with her dad. So now both my kids, although I just said earlier CPS wasn't involved and I didn't have a DUI and I didn't have all these things, it was only a matter of time for me anyways that all that would have happened eventually. And it was happening. CPS wasn't involved, but yet my kids left me. Like, they left on their own accord. They were babies when they decided to leave, you know? And when I think about how I was back then, you know, I was that mom who alcohol was more important to me than picking my kids up from daycare. Alcohol was more important to me than providing dinner for them. Alcohol was more important to me than shopping for school supplies for them. My kids, you know, many times went to school the first day of school with hardly anything. And not because I couldn't financially afford it, but because it wasn't important to me. That's the truth. You know, I could sit up here and I can give you all these like stories of all these fun parties that I went to, but I feel like when I'm asked to speak, to share my experience, strength, and hope, I have to share some of the nitty-gritty stuff that really, really brought it down for me, and stuff that really like hits my core, where I get teary-eyed thinking about it. Because they're my babies, you know? And, you know, I took them places where they were unsafe. I put them in harm's way all the time. And there were many times when, you know, I promised that I would take them to the park. And that park never happened. And they were sitting in front of the TV watching, you know, whatever, and eating cereal, if I had milk at the time in the fridge. And the whole entire time, my family didn't know. They did not know, because I kept that real secret until, and by the grace of God, my kids decided to go, enough is enough. And how amazing is that, that they decided enough was enough. Because I don't know if that would have, if that didn't happen, and if my mom didn't come up to me and tell me, hey, you know, I think we've got a problem here, I don't know if I would have ever gotten sober. I really don't. I don't know if I would ever be here today, you know, having over 11 years sobriety. I don't think that would have ever happened. Yeah, so when I think about what I did to my family and my kids, that's the stuff, that's the core that hits home for me. And I created a lot of wreckage drinking, and a lot of damage. And so when I decided to get sober, I don't even know if it was really a choice at the time. It was all kind of a blur when I first got sober. I just remember going to that first meeting and then going home and thinking, how am I going to stay sober? How am I going to not use? And not knowing what to do. And when I had gone to that women's meeting, I had women who reached out to me. I had women who gave me that little pamphlet with all their little numbers on there. But are you kidding? My pride would never let me call those numbers at all. I looked at it several times. I brought it out of my purse. Nope, not going to happen. Put it back in my purse. My pride and my ego was a big driving force for where I was at in my life. And so I remember the first day that I got sober, and I also remember the morning, the next day. And I remember not feeling as tired. And I remember looking in the mirror. Because when, towards the end of my drinking career and my drug usage, I was probably a lot skinnier than I am now. And I, but it wasn't even that was different. It was the grayness in my eyes. You know, I have these beautiful brown eyes, and they weren't brown, they were gray. And they were gray, and I had dark circles and sunken in, and I was losing my hair, and my skin looked unhealthy, and I remember looking in the mirror, getting ready to go, and not even makeup could help me. Like, that's how shitty I looked. And I remember that next day that I got clean and sober, I looked in the mirror and I thought, wow, I saw a little, just a tiny, tiny, I mean, it had only been a day, but I saw a little brightness, enough brightness for me to get my ass to another meeting. Now, I don't know what that was, but I know that it wasn't me. And as I continued with my recovery today, now I know it was God working in my life, right? But when I decided to take that route, I literally, I didn't know what I was going to do. I was going to lose my job. Where was I going to live? How was I going to support? All these things started coming to my mind. And I just had this woman who came up to me in one of the meetings. And so, of course, I went to, they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. So I did. I didn't understand it at all. I didn't understand the steps on there. I didn't understand, definitely didn't understand the traditions at all. I mean, it was all very foreign to me. And I lived at the Alano Club in Linwood. They had meetings throughout the day, and I would often stay for 3 meetings in a day because I was too fucking afraid to go outside and be around alcohol and be around people who drank alcohol. I didn't know at that point what I was going to do. How was I going to have fun? How was I going to go bowling? How was I going to go camping? How was I going to do any of these things sober? But something stuck in me when the woman came up to me who had a lot of years sobriety, and she reached her hand out to me, and she had seen me try to skip out of the meeting early because I was known for that. I would stay for like the first half, and then I would scoot out right before we started, you know, definitely before we held hands to say the prayer for sure, And she ran after me, don't go, come back in. And something in that woman's voice when she said that to me, where I finally kind of like, I don't even know if I surrendered at that time, but something inside me was surrendering little by little by little. For me, because I had such a chip on my shoulder constantly, it was like little bits of icebergs were breaking away. The more that I kept coming to meetings, and it was chipping away, and I no longer wanted to tell people to go fuck themselves. I wanted to say hello, right? And I no longer wanted to scoot out of the meeting. I no longer wanted to not hold hands. And you know, I owe a lot to this program. And when I think about my story and I think about where I've come from, I was probably about 2 years sobriety. And of course, by that point, I had worked my steps. And I found a letter that my oldest daughter had written me. And there was that part of me that I didn't want to read it. But I broke the letter out and I read it. And it was pretty heartbreaking. And it it talked about how she didn't know if I was ever going to come home at night. She was worried that I was going to die. She didn't know she knew I had a problem before I even knew I had a problem. It talked about how she took care of her younger sister. And the letter was enough for me to just break down and really just, at that point, you know, being a little bit sober at that point, I thought, this is really hard. I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can face all this, all the stuff that I had done, you know? And all I can say is, what other choice did I have at that point, really? I guess I had choices, but for me, looking at my kids and looking at my mom, and my dad does play a part in my life, but unfortunately he's an absent father and we always lived apart. But looking at my family and knowing how much pain I caused them, I just didn't know if I could go back to that old life again. So, at about, I'd say probably about 2 months sobriety, it was raining, it was storming actually, and my family had a family gathering, and they all drank, they're normies, they drank, they can do it. And I remember it was like a round table and there was wine everywhere. And something inside of me triggered, and I thought, oh my God, I'm losing it. I definitely want to have a drink right now. And I remember running to the meeting, the Alano Club, and there wasn't a meeting there. For some reason, they were like cleaning it out. They were cleaning it. The cleaning lady was there, but there was no meeting. And I remember sitting in my car, and at that point, not knowing what to do. And I put my head down, and I prayed. And so I like to talk about this because being raised Roman Catholic, God has always existed in my life. I didn't know any different. I always knew that there was a God out there. I wanted to be a nun when I was like 8 years old until I knew that they weren't able to date boys. And I thought, forget it. That's definitely not my calling. But I knew at that point, I mean, you know, I always had God. And I remember praying by the rosary. And I remember going to Mass. And I went to catechism and all that. And even that, and that spiritual basis that I had, even at a young age, didn't keep me sober. Even that didn't. And even and all those times when I was using, I would use the 911 prayer, and I always say that 911 prayer where I'm like, please God, don't let me get pulled over right now because I have a lot of cocaine on me and I could go away for a long time, or please God, I'm drinking and driving right now, I need to get home. I did a lot of those prayers, not a lot of sincerity going into it. So it wasn't that I you hear people saying, well, I felt like God left me. I never felt God left me. I truly feel like I left my higher power by choice. That was my choice. I left it because I would then have to be accountable for all the things and all the stuff that I was doing that I knew in the back of my mind was wrong. And I'd have to be accountable to that. And that scared the living crap out of me. I didn't know how to go that route. So all I can say is as I got, so, you know, in the beginning of my years of recovery, I really dived into this thing, and I did what they told me to do. And being told what to do was not easy for me. It was like, don't you know who I am? Again, that whole talk, you know, I'm really important. I don't follow rules very well, right? And the whole, you know, you need to work the steps. You need to get a sponsor. You need to get a female sponsor and not a male sponsor. I was like, oh God, great, right? Because immediately I thought, well, male sponsor, that'll work out perfect. That was how my mind, that was how I was programmed. And I was so blessed because in my early years, I had women with a lot of years take me under their wing and go, no, Kalei, you need to get a female sponsor. That's not right. And no, you can't date for, you know, the first year. And I thought, oh my God, are you kidding me? You know, you need to get a plant before you, you know. And I'm like, I kill plants. That's not going to work for me. I don't have a green thumb. Everybody knows this. I don't cook and I don't garden. And but I'm really grateful for the women in the program that gave me that opportunity to be able to see who I am today. And so I got a sponsor and I worked the steps. And I went to meetings every day. And yeah, and I started reaching my hand out to other women like I was told to do. I didn't really want to do that either because I really didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to be helpful. I don't want to say I went against the grain a lot, but I did in a sense. I really fought it for a while until about, and when I reached a year of sobriety was probably the scariest moment because I thought, great, I got this coin now. Everybody's clapping, everybody's giving, you know, birthday cake and all this. And now I really have to live up to this. Like, oh my God, what am I gonna do? I really, you know, so I didn't, you know, I didn't really work my steps, and I don't recommend this to new people, but I didn't work my steps up probably closer to like a year sobriety. And I think if I had to do it again, I would definitely do it right away. I wouldn't wait. But that's my story, and that's where I'm at today. But I worked the steps, and I was able to really outline the person that I was. And when we did that inventory, and we went through all those character defects, and we started looking at how selfish and how, oh, I was a bully. I had no idea. I thought I was a really nice person. I was a bully, and I intimidated people, and I used people, and I was a thief, and I lied, and all these terrible things on paper. And that was an eye-opening experience. I would say when I hear people talk about the spiritual experience, I would say I probably had my spiritual experience after I did my inventory. I would say I had that spiritual experience when I went home and I sat quietly for a little bit, and I thought, and I looked at that paper, and there was a large list of things that I didn't want to be anymore. And I just knew that I couldn't go back to the old life. And I knew that I needed to put as much effort that I put into using and drinking and waiting for the dope man and getting and scrounging up change for booze, you know. And because, you know, even though I had this job and I had this money, I never had any money. I don't really know how that worked out, but that just tells you right there, like that whole responsible facade that I had, I wasn't really that responsible. So, but today though, when I think of my recovery and I think of where I am today, because it's already almost time. It's fantastic. keep going? Okay. When I think about today, I think about my daughters, and I think about, you know, when it comes to my birthdays, how they are so excited for me every time I get it. My AA birthday is probably more important than my belly button birthday. I brought them to meetings with me when they were little, and they've grown up in AA. They know my life is AA. When you come to my house, I have big books laying around. I have your, you know, recovery literature. I've married someone in AA. And so I was blessed to be able to have that experience of falling in love with another alcoholic. Well, and it's wonderful. But you know, this is all for me. These are gifts that they talk about. This is the promises that they talk about. And when we read those promises, this is what I get to have today. I get to have a healthy, loving, kind relationship. I get to show up for work. I get to set clear boundaries. I get to be of service. You know, I get to show up even when I'm not necessarily excited to show up. When my daughters call, when I'm at work and my 22-year-old calls and I see her name come up on the phone, there's that part of me that goes, oh God, here we go. Because she, you know, she can, yeah. And so, but I answer that phone, you know. Hi, Michaela. How's everything going? And I take that 2-5 minutes to talk to her. I've had the opportunity to be able to have another child in sobriety, and he is 7 years old, and his name is Caleb, and he has never seen me drink or use. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I have a strong connection, you know, friends. Let's talk about that for a minute. I mean, I had a lot of friends, so I thought, when I was using. I had a lot of, you know, I was popular. I had a lot of people that liked me, and I liked them. And I'll tell you right now, when it all came boiled down to it, and the shit really came down, none of them were around. None of them. And the people who stuck around, I can tell you right now on one hand, that would be my mother, my father, and my children. That is it. Everybody else had pretty much written me off, or, you know, I wasn't important at that point. And I didn't have the booze, and I didn't have the drugs that I was supplying anymore, so I wasn't important. But in sobriety, I have been able to experience friendships that are incredible, you know. So my husband and I lived over in Edmonds I lived over there for about 20 years. So I moved to Washington when I was 19. And when we moved here to Port Angeles, I have to say I was a little scared, you know. My husband has 15 years and we're both active in the program. But I was scared to come to a new surrounding, new area where I didn't know anyone. And I am floored with how loving and kind and supportive everybody has been here. And it just goes to show you that wherever I go, wherever I travel to, when I go to a meeting, although I don't know people, I do know you, because we all share that same common denominator, and that is that feeling of helplessness, that feeling of loneliness, that feeling of not being enough. And so I suffered from that, not being enough. I was never enough for me. And I, you know, today I live a life that I never dreamed that I would be able to live. You know, I'm graduating massage school in November. I mean, who the heck would have thought I would have been a massage therapist 10 years? That would have been all bad. And so that would have been like on Highway 99 with a flashing sign or something. I don't know, but definitely not good. And I meditate daily. Like, that never existed. See, even though I had this religion based and I grew up with this, I never meditate. What is that? I never knew what that was, to get quiet. I have a job that I'm really grateful for. I just have a lot to be grateful for today. So when Sally asked me do you want to speak? I was told when I first came in here that when you're asked to speak, you don't question, you say yes. Because my story might hit home to somebody else, and that then might trigger something in that person. And my constantly today, my life is, you know, I have people coming up to me, and I have women coming up to me where I can be of service. And I'm just really grateful for the program, and I'm grateful for my recovery. I'm grateful for this room and all you guys in here, and thanks. All right.